Thanks very much. Thanks for coming in for 9 o'clock. Okay, how does this? So today I'm going to go through some of the stuff that Carl talked about yesterday. But first, I'm just going to discuss briefly what I mean by schizophrenia and what it might be applied to. And talk about two key kind of neurobiological abnormalities in the disorder, which I think pretty much everyone would agree on. How you then interpret those abnormalities and model them is probably more contentious. But one of these, as Carl mentioned yesterday, is this idea of a loss of synaptic gain at high levels in the cortical hierarchy. And another is an increase in striatal dopamine. And I'm going to talk about the idea of precision and how precision might relate to synaptic gain. And I'm going to talk about the various roles put forward for dopamine and how these might implicate theories of schizophrenia. And then I'm going to switch to talking a bit less mechanistically about attempts to model how delusions might come about. And these kind of fall into two categories, the classic kind of jumping to conclusions type effect, which is an explanation of how delusional ideas might arise, and then what I'd call sticking to conclusions, or a mechanism whereby these ideas might stay, because getting a strange belief and then hanging on to that belief might be two very different kinds of process. And lastly, if there's time permitting, I'll talk a bit more about attempts to model negative symptoms with predominantly reinforcement learning models. Okay, so just as a very brief intro for people who might not be familiar with the concept of schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is essentially quite a heterogeneous syndrome, and for the diagnosis you need just two of any of these symptoms, which are divided up into these different categories that you can see here. Now, the commonest symptoms and the most the kind of man in the street madness symptoms are these positive, so-called positive symptoms at the top, delusions and hallucinations. And in schizophrenia, in particular, the commonest kinds of delusions are the kind of persecutory delusions, feelings that people are out to get you in some way. But there are many others. And in terms of hallucinations, the commonest are hearing voices, but there are also hallucinations in other modalities. And another important group of symptoms, which I've already alluded to, are these negative symptoms, which are essentially not the presence of something abnormal, but the absence of something that should be there. So a lack of willpower, a lack of sociability, lack of emotional expression. So it's kind of this family and this family that I'm largely going to talk about today. I'm not going to talk about any of these psychomotor phenomena or cognitive or disorganisation. And what, just to give a brief background to these, what I've described are these two major kind of neurobiological pathologies in schizophrenia. So firstly, we have this idea of a loss of synaptic gain in higher hierarchical areas of the cortex. So what is the evidence for this? So this is there's a large amount of genetic evidence which implicates the NMDA receptor, a specific kind of glutamate receptor, which is very important for the control of synaptic gain, and also the postsynaptic density and the signaling pathways that lead from the NMDA receptor to its intracellular effects, like the production of other excitatory receptors, and et cetera, et cetera. And in neuropathological evidence, you can see fewer glutamatergic synapses especially in prefrontal cortex and hippocampus, i.e. high hierarchical areas. Thirdly, you have this idea that ketamine, which is an NMDA receptor antagonist, can induce psychotic-like symptoms, not proper psychotic symptoms, but symptoms which are reasonably close. And there is also evidence that there's hypofunction of GABAergic interneurons, particularly in prefrontal cortex, which themselves have NMDA receptors. And so if the NMDA receptors aren't working, it may be a cause of interneuronal dysfunction. And these GABA interneurons are extremely important for setting up this kind of balance of excitatory and inhibitory firing, which permits sustained oscillations in prefrontal cortex. And without being able, if you can't sustain oscillatory firing, then the prefrontal cortex is less able to communicate with other areas, because as populations in separated areas that oscillate together are better able to communicate with each other. And so an impairment of this oscillatory function is like an impairment of oscillatory gain, really, rather than synaptic gain per se. And also there's a small amount of evidence for dopamine hyperactivity in D1 receptor hyperactivity in prefrontal cortex. So put all of these things together and you have a loss of synaptic gain, a loss of influence of prefrontal and hippocampal cortex over the rest of the cortical hierarchy. And on the other hand, probably the most famous abnormality in schizophrenia is this hyper-dopaminergic state in the striatum, especially at D2 receptors. And this was first discovered because it was noted that all antipsychotic drugs, and this remains the case even today after 60 years, work by blocking D2 receptors specifically. And in the last kind of 20 years or more, lots of PET studies have shown that in schizophrenia there's an increased presynaptic availability, so an increased synthesis of dopamine and release when provoked. So it seems that this is a presynaptic effect rather than any kind of dopamine 2 receptor pathology. The receptors are increased a small amount, but not a huge amount. And also added to this is the point that chronic amphetamine use and other chronic dopaminergic agonist use can also cause psychosis. So we have these two kinds of effects which might be worth trying to model. And just to illustrate this, as Carl was making the point yesterday, this loss of synaptic gain at the top of the hierarchy seems also to be counterbalanced by an increase at the bottom, which may be a compensatory response to that. It might not be a primary pathology in its own right. And you can see it really nicely illustrated on the study from Alan Antisevich, where he just compared the connectivity of every single cortical area with the thalamus. And plotted the differences in connectivity between schizophrenic subjects and control subjects on this same brain. And you can see that the areas which are on average less connected to the thalamus in the schizophrenic subjects are this the prefrontal cortex, the cingulate cortex, the medial temporal lobe, all these high hierarchical areas. But you can see also, perfectly delineated, all these primary cortical areas which are more connected than they should be. So M1, S1, A1, and V1. So it's almost like an imbalance of synaptic gain in the hierarchy. And another point worth bearing in mind is this idea that put forward by Oliver Howes and Shishir Kapoor that perhaps this frontotemporal dysfunction that we've already talked about and other genetic factors and stress and drugs might all contribute in some way to this increased synthesis of dopamine, although why this should be on a neurobiological level or indeed a computational level, nobody's really got any good idea. And then this increased dopamine release then leads to psychotic symptoms. So they propose perhaps this is the kind of final common pathway of psychosis. It's worth bearing in mind that this does seem to be the case for many people with schizophrenia. So if you look at striatal dopamine synthesis in healthy volunteers and compare that to people with psychosis. In psychosis, it's significantly elevated. Not by masses, but significantly. But if you look at people who do not respond to anti-dopaminergic treatment, you don't find a significant elevation, and instead you find more glutamatergic abnormalities in cingulate cortex. So even this might not actually be a final common pathway. There may be other routes to the same symptoms. Anyway, so with that on board, we'll talk about a bit more about this loss of synaptic gain and how it might be modelled in Bayesian terms. Repeating a lot of what Carl said yesterday, in fact. So I don't need to reintroduce the idea of the Bayesian brain, but the key point really is that the reason these statistics are described as Bayesian is that it involves averaging or combining the information from two different probability distributions according to their precision. So you take an average of these two means, but you weight them according to whichever piece of information is the most precise. So precision is extremely important in Bayesian inference. And our point is that if you reduce the precision of prior beliefs, which is what we believe is happening in schizophrenia, then you will shift your posterior belief towards your sensory evidence in this way. That's the whole point, really, in a nutshell. And how are prior beliefs and how does Bayesian inference actually take place in the brain? Well, a popular model of doing so is this idea of predictive coding, in which a generative model makes predictions of sensory input that cascade down this hierarchy, as Carl was illustrating yesterday. And as they descend, they come right down to the bottom and are compared with sensory input, and any error signal is fed back to revise this prediction. If it cannot revise this prediction, another error signal is sent up and so on and so forth. And this model has had, this is a well-known paper by Rao and Ballard in 15 years ago now, showing that you can explain a lot of V1 receptive field appearances by training a predictive coding network on natural images. But if the brain is performing Bayesian inference in this way, and if it's using the kind of distributions that Christoph was talking about yesterday, so Gaussian distributions or distributions that can be described quite simply with the two sufficient statistics, their mean and their precision, then the mean and precision ought to be encoded neurobiologically in a way that allows them to interact in the way that they should interact in inference. And so Carl's point when he was talking about precision and synaptic gain yesterday is essentially that if you're looking for a mechanism of turning up the volume on one piece of information and turning the volume down on another piece of information without actually changing the content of that information, what you want is a kind of multiplicative factor, just like synaptic gain, that doesn't create information out of nothing, but can turn the volume up or down on existing activity. And so this could be done by neuromodulators like dopamine or acetylcholine or serotonin, etc. But it also could happen in other ways like oscillatory dynamics, etc. Anything that can increase the influence of one message over another. And it's been known, it's not a new idea by any means, that there is a loss of influence of predictions over perceptions in schizophrenia. So as Carl mentioned yesterday, we have these smooth pursuit traces of a normal subject pursuing a target that just goes backwards and forwards at constant velocity. And you can see when the target's switched off, the subject can carry on pursuing it at almost the correct speed. And this part is driven purely by prediction, right? But this schizophrenic subject can pursue it absolutely fine for this moment, but when the target's switched off, he just loses that little bit extra of velocity and has to saccade much more to catch up when the target reappears. And this subject, you notice, is falling behind even when the target is visible. But notice his saccades are perfect, so he's saccading back to the target. He can see the target. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's his predictive ability that is the problem. And this is this lack of prediction is recapitulated in lots of other phenomena. So the hollow mask that you saw yesterday, most people perceive this as a convex face, but those with schizophrenia perceive it as a concave face, which is veridical. They tend not to perceive these as different sizes, whereas most people do. And they tend not to be able to perceive these this egg shape in this ring of gabble patches. But you can look for these predictive deficits in all different kinds of modalities. So in the world of ERPs, when you present a sensory stimulus many, many times, average the cortical potentials and look for these characteristic waveforms that are produced by noticing a sensory stimulus, you get, if you just present two simple clicks to a control subject, you get one characteristic wave after the first click and then a smaller wave after the second click. It's almost as if something about the first click has led the cortex to be if this is produced by predominantly a prediction error response, then it looks like the cortex has been able to predict this click a bit better than this click. However, in the schizophrenic subject here, this first click is produces the same kind of wave as the control subject, but the second one produces exactly the same as the first. So there doesn't seem to be the same predictive change. This second stimulus looks inappropriately surprising. Conversely, if you produce a whole train of clicks and then an oddball, like a beep, 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 boop, then normal subjects will produce a much bigger deflection at a later time to the deviant. And you can see that here at 150 milliseconds and here again at 300 milliseconds. But these schizophrenic subjects do not seem to differentiate as much between the normal and the abnormal stimulus. So in this case, this oddball is inappropriately unsurprising. As Carl was saying yesterday, everything seems mildly surprising, except for the stuff that really should be surprising. And Chris Frith and Sarah Blakemore in the late 90s produced a model of passivity symptoms, and which was based on the idea that if you predict the outcome of your movements before you actually get the sensory feedback, then if something goes wrong with this prediction, it may lead to a state in which your movements, even though you're commanding them, feel as if they're caused by some sort of alien force, or feel unfamiliar to you in some way. And some predictions of this model have been subsequently verified, for example, in that force matching task that Carl talked about yesterday. So the question is, are all of these predictive deficits really explicable by just simply turning the precision down at a high level? They may not be. And as the examples that Carl showed yesterday showed, that when we tried to reproduce these symptoms by modelling them with a hierarchical model and just increasing the noise at a higher level in that hierarchical model, we were able to reproduce the mismatch negativity and the smooth pursuit abnormalities and the force matching paradigm just by reducing that precision. So potentially it seems a decent explanation. I'm not going to go through this model now, as there isn't time. And you've seen that already. But here you can see in our schizophrenic computer subject tracking this stimulus, you can see every time the eye tracks this target through the occluder, it can track the target fine to begin with, but when it enters the occluder, it just slows down that little bit more than the normal subject's eye on each occasion, and a lot on this occasion. Okay, but can this reduced high-level precision account really be the whole story? Can it explain everything about the syndrome? And we've seen it can explain some of these perceptual phenomena, these smooth pursuit abnormalities, some electrophysiological findings, the passivity phenomena, and even the kind of delusional ideas, or this state in which the world seems kind of mysterious and odd, and you're kind of noticing bizarre coincidences everywhere from which you might draw odd conclusions. But thinking about it, the characteristic symptoms, the most commonest symptoms that we really, really want to explain are hallucinations and the maintenance of these fixed false beliefs, which are impervious to sensory evidence. And so a priori, it seems as if a hallucination, if it's anything, is the imposition of a prior belief on noisy or absent sensory data. And likewise, a delusion. Now, I would actually argue that these symptoms can be best explained in this kind of model. I don't have time to do that. Don't have time to go into that now. But it may be that this the maintenance of delusions is a different process, and we have to look at a different model for that. And I'll come on to that in a moment. So we'll talk about striatal dopamine. So in Rob's talk yesterday, he outlined the different kinds of dopaminergic responses that you get in the striatum. And this is a raster plot of lots and lots of dopaminergic neurons. And you can see they're all kind of ticking away at this tonic kind of firing rate. And then in the middle of this, you have some stimulus is applied, and there's this phasic burst firing when the stimulus is applied. And then on a different stimulus, there's a phasic pause. So you have this tonic level, these phasic bursts, and these phasic pauses. And as Rob also mentioned yesterday, there are various prominent theories as to what these, particularly these phasic responses, are all about. So on the one hand, there's lots of evidence that that these phasic responses compute a kind of reward prediction error by comparing the amount of value that you get from moving one state and to another state with the actual reward that you got, and then using the prediction error signal to learn more about those states and revise your estimate of the value of those states so that in future you can make a better prediction. So this is all about learning. But on the other hand, you have these other theories of dopamine put forward by Kent Berridge and others that say that dopamine isn't used for learning, or certainly in his paradigms isn't used for learning, and instead is all about action selection and translating something, the presence of some stimulus that you like, into something that you're prepared to work for. And he terms this quality incentive salience. And so how might these be perturbed in schizophrenia, and do these account for any symptoms? So we have this clear evidence that there is a much greater presynaptic availability of dopamine in the striatum. And it does seem that there is more tonic release, because the antipsychotics act in a tonic way, blocking D2 receptors. But what might happen for this phasic release pattern? Well, in other psychiatric syndromes, it's thought that there is some kind of inverse relationship between the tonic and phasic release, because there is some feedback on some autoreceptor feedback reducing phasic release when tonic release is high. So, for example, if you have a normal state with tonic firing and phasic firing, if tonic firing goes down, phasic firing can go up, and this is purported to be an explanation for impulsivity phenomena. Whereas when tonic firing increases in pain and stress syndromes, you can get blunting of this phasic signaling. But it seems in schizophrenia, really, that, and we'll come on to this shortly, that if anything, it's not as simple as this. It seems that the phasic responses are anything not just diminished but disordered in some way. Their computation seems aberrant, and it may actually be the inputs to the dopamine neurons that we should be looking at, not the dopamine neurons themselves. So it's worth mentioning at this point a very prominent, well-known theory of schizophrenia known as the aberrant salience hypothesis. And this was put forward by Shitij Kapoor around 10 years ago. And this hypothesis was very much based on the incentive salience account of dopaminergic function. And he proposed that this abnormal phasic release of dopamine, so a kind of random phasic release of dopamine, essentially, confers incentive stimuli or incentive salience on random stimuli or whatever you happen to be looking at that time. So if I'm looking around the room and I suddenly get a squirt of dopamine and I notice Jowsy is looking at me, I think, why the hell is she looking at me? Does she want to kill me? And in his account, the delusions are a cognitive scheme that the patient develops to explain this aberrant salience experience. So in this account, he's not really positing any abnormal learning, any abnormal cognition. It's a kind of a reasonable explanation of these aberrant salience experiences. But this is a very popular account, but in some ways it doesn't quite... ring true. So for one thing, delusions seem to be so strange that there does seem to be some abnormal learning taking place. It seems surprising that you could explain them all through incentive salience experiences just engendering the apparently rational cognitive explanations. Secondly, incentive salience is supposed to be good. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to make you approach things and work for them. But the schizophrenic psychosis in particular is characteristically an extremely aversive state. You perceive threats everywhere. It's a frightening state. Now this explanation might work much better, in fact, for something like manic psychosis, where people feel the world is full of opportunity and they're prepared to go and work for it. But for schizophrenic psychosis, it seems to be missing something important. So, on the other hand, people have also tried to look at how you might explain schizophrenic symptoms using the reward prediction error hypothesis, as opposed to the incentive salience hypothesis. And a huge amount of work on this subject was done by Paul Fletcher and his colleagues, Phil Corlett and Graham Murray in Cambridge in the last 10 years. And they devised tasks in which you could elicit what ought to be either reward prediction error signals or causal inference prediction error signals, where there was no explicit reward in the task. There were just causal inferences that were there to be made. And he showed that in the salient conditions in each of these tasks, and by salient he just means that it's a condition that ought to elicit a prediction error, in control subjects, you see this substantial signal in the midbrain in the reward prediction error time of the task and in the causal inference task. But in the schizophrenic subjects, this pattern is completely distorted. So there's no difference between the prediction error time and the non-prediction error time in each of these paradigms. And this finding was then subsequently replicated with some interesting kind of laterality effects by Morris et al. But the weird thing is that despite this very abnormal bold response, the learning in the actual tasks was almost normal. And so it didn't really... It was a great finding, but it didn't seem to translate to a behavioural effect. So there are various possibilities for why this might be the case. The one possibility is the subjects are just doing the task in a different way. Or another possibility, which Fletcher and Frith talk about in their paper, is that perhaps this is not the actual reward prediction error itself, but encoding the precision of a reward prediction error or other update encoded somewhere else. And if the precision is perhaps abnormal, but the prediction error is still being coded elsewhere, that perhaps this allows people to be able to do the task better than you otherwise would expect. So coming on to modelling delusions, and firstly I'm going to talk about jumping to conclusions. Now, this Beads task has become extremely popular in schizophrenia research because, unlike those paradigms I just talked about just now, it's a paradigm in which the behaviour of schizophrenic subjects tends to be reliably abnormal. I guess most of you are familiar with it, but if you're not, you essentially show the subject these two jars, or you show a picture of these two jars on the computer, and one of them has a kind of 80 to 20 ratio of green to yellow beads, and another has an 80 to 20 ratio the opposite way around. And you put them below the desk, and then you start to draw out a sequence and ask people to judge which jar they are coming from. And there's different ways of doing it. You can ask them to just stop you as soon as they've decided and they don't need to see any more. Or you can ask them to rate the probability of each jar after seeing every single bead, and there's no, and the task never stops. You just keep going. And it was found by Philippa Garrity and colleagues 30 years ago that most normal subjects seeing this sequence would decide on either bead number 3 or bead number 5 that they're quite happy that this is the mainly green jar. And you can see that here, plotted here. But on these deluded psychotic subjects, you can see almost half of them are deciding on the very first bead, that they don't need to see any more. This jar is green. And this seemed to be the first really robust evidence that there's something odd or something wrong going on in cognition in schizophrenia. But this task has been used many times, but people haven't really explored exactly what is going on behind this reasoning abnormality. So for one thing, subjects might be overweighting evidence. So if you think of it with an aberrant salience hat on, if you have a big squirt of dopamine on each bead that's bigger than it should be, you might update your probabilities of the jar more than people update their probability. Or you might reach the same conclusion that after only one bead, it's probably 65-70% likely to be the green jar. But that threshold, that probability is good enough for you and you're willing to make a decision on that basis. So maybe you just have a lower decision threshold. And I think to begin with, people were much more in the overweighting evidence camp. But in a study done by Bruno Averbeck in Suki Shergill's lab a few years ago, he showed that in a sequence learning task where you could actually quantify how much people learn from positive feedback and from negative feedback, he showed that the patients seemed to learn less from positive feedback than the controls. So if anything, they were underweighting positive evidence, not overweighting it. And what does this mean for the beads task? Well, he gave the beads task to those same group of patients, and he replicated this classic effect of about half of them deciding on the first bead. But he also showed that the less people learned from positive feedback in his other task, the more likely they were to decide on the first bead, i.e. the people who were jumping to conclusions were also the people who were learning least from evidence. So it did not seem to be an overweighting evidence phenomenon. And then Michael Matusis, who jumped in with an analysis of lots of draws to decision beads data, and he modelled these using two different models. So this first model was an ideal Bayesian observer model which had three parameters, and these parameters are very interesting because people had never really. I don't think people have ever really examined this question. But so one of the parameters was the cost of the wrong decision. So it may be that the patient doing this task just doesn't care about the experiment, just picks the first bead and thinks, okay, I'm going to decide, I'm going to get out of here, I'm going to take the money and go. I don't care about doing your experiment properly. They have very little cost of making a wrong decision. Or they could have a difference in their sampling cost. So they could be more embarrassed about asking the experimenter for another bead. And from these two costs, you can compute a value of either deciding red or deciding blue or of sampling again. And the other important parameter which he had in his model was this temperature parameter governing the decision noise. So he talked a bit about this yesterday, but I don't know how familiar people are with softmax decision models, so I'll just go through this again quickly. So this softmax model allows you to convert a difference in values between two options into an actual decision. And so if you plot on this x-axis how much better the red decision seems to you than the other options, if red is better, then you're in this part of the graph. If it's worse, then you're in this part of the graph. And on the y-axis, you've got the probability of deciding red, actually making that decision. Now, if you're a perfectly rational decision maker, then the minute you're in this half of the graph, you should decide red with probability 1. I.e., this graph should be a step function that goes like this. But obviously, we're not perfectly rational decision makers. There's some stochasticity in our responding. And the more stochasticity there is, the flatter this curve gets. So even if red, there's an advantage to choosing red at this point, say, I might still be 20% likely to choose blue, or et cetera, et cetera. So he had that model, and he also compared this with a much simpler model, which just, in effect, took a ratio of red to blue beads, and as soon as it was over a threshold, chose the jar as being red, simple as that. And there were some interesting, he found some interesting things. So setting, in order to estimate the parameters, he had to set the cost of the wrong decision to a set rate for everybody. But this revealed that there didn't seem to be any difference between groups in the cost of sampling. People didn't mind about asking for other beads. But what did really jump out was the difference between the acutely paranoid patients, acutely psychotic patients, and these remitted patients in healthy controls. You can see this. They had, the acutely paranoid patients had a much, much higher temperature parameter. They seem to be making much noisier responses. And this also does come with the caveat, as Michael mentioned yesterday, that if everything is explained by an increase in this decision temperature parameter, it may be that the subject is just noisier, or it may be just that, that your model doesn't contain the key thing that is making the basis, that which is encoding the basis on which they're making their decision. But another interesting thing was that the paranoid patients and the remitted patients actually seemed to be using, had more evidence for using the simpler model, whereas the healthy controls seemed to favour the more complex model where people looked into the future and gauged how many draws are remaining, etc. So this is the kind of result which would be great for computational psychiatry to develop, you know, a test that can differentiate between groups on the basis of a diagnosis, whether symptoms are present or not, and then maybe another test that can quantify the amount of symptoms, i.e. a kind of state test rather than a trait test. But in this kind of procession from thinking, i.e. evaluating the probabilities of states, and then acting, is it that this temperature parameter this noisy decision-making might explain the whole of these jumping-to-conclusions type effects? Well, if you do the draws-to-decision test in schizophrenic patients, you do find that the effect size for the draws-to-decision is very, very high in those patients. So this effect size is around 1. But if you eliminate this deciding aspect and just ask them to rate what they think of the probabilities of the jar after every bead, so you're taking away this softmax decision part, they still perform abnormally but less so. So the effect size is smaller in this rating of certainty after every bead. So it may be that there is still some abnormal rating of the probability of the jar, but the evidence for this is not amazing. So this is the best evidence I could find. And this is from a study by Peters and Garrity, and you can see that this deluded group, plotted here in blue, are seeing a sequence of beads going red, 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 green. And you can see that they just seem to make a bigger deflection here when they see counter evidence, and again here. But these effects are not big, and this is, I think, probably a much more characteristic sample. I think it's a bigger sample. These are delusional schizophrenic patients plotted in pink here and healthy controls in red. And you can see that there is a bit of a bigger adjustment, but it's not hugely impressive. So moving on now, we're now to the question of why people might stick to conclusions. Because the problem with explaining delusions using the jumping to conclusions model is that whatever your explanation of jumping to conclusions, whether it's lower decision thresholds or more stochasticity in decision making, or even a greater belief updating, none of these explain how delusions can become fixed, because you need the opposite process to explain how they are maintained. You have an increased learning rate process in the beginning, and then no learning rate following that. So we tried to look at this phenomenon in schizotypal subjects, doing another beads test, but asking them to rate the probability of each bead and employing a change of jar in the middle. So this is a bit like a reversal learning kind of paradigm. And we modeled their responses using this Christoph's hierarchical Gaussian filter. And the important details are that here's the bead that the subject sees. And at this next level is the probability of that bead coming from the red jar from the subject's point of view. And at the top here, we have this volatility term, the subject. The extent to which the subject believes that the jar might change at any point. And obviously you think if the jar is very likely to change, this is going to change. This is going to have a big effect on your perception of a blue bead if you think the jar is currently red. If you think it's very likely to change, you're much more likely to revise your estimate about the identity of the jar if you see counter evidence. If you don't, then you're not. And then at the bottom here, we just have the decision part. So this is the probability of the jar generating where the subject puts that point on the slider with a bit of softmax temperature decision noise at the bottom. And if you plot out these quantities, so the graph on the next slide has this x3, x2 and x1 plotted out, you can see the effect that this volatility belief has on the other variables. So on the bottom here, you have the beads that people actually see, the blue, red, etc. The diamonds are where they actually put the pointer on the sliding scale, and the purple line is the model fit. And if you look at the top, you can see this belief about the volatility. This is a low schizotypy subject, and it's characteristic of a low schizotypy subject. You see the belief about the volatility doesn't really change throughout. It starts at this level and kind of stays still. And this means that at this second level, plotting the tendency towards the red or blue jars, that the subject believes fairly quickly that the jar is red, but they retain these large confidence intervals about their estimate. They retain some substantial uncertainty about this estimate throughout. And then this means that when the evidence changes, they can make a rapid update to their belief. And so very quickly they switch to the blue jar over here. But if you compare this to a highly schizotypal subject, you get a very different picture. So this subject, you can see, reaches a decision about the red beads fairly early on. But takes much, much, much longer to revise this belief after the evidence changes. So he takes almost the end of the sequence to be really sure. And in fact, this is a reversal learning problem in effect, although reversal inference, I guess you'd say. And you can see the model explains this by starting off at the same level of volatility as before, but then declining and declining. And this means that although the confidence intervals about the jar shrink because you think it's less likely to change, you become more confident about the jar, but then when the evidence changes, it takes you much, much longer to change your mind because the learning rate is proportional to the uncertainty at this level, as Christoph was saying yesterday. And this level at which it's asymptotes, M, is significantly correlated with the degree of schizotypy across all our subjects. And so what we're wondering is whether this level M is proportional to or perhaps encoded by activity at midbrain dopamine 2 receptors. And why would this be? So in this task that Haneke's task, which Mark talked about yesterday, this is a reversal learning paradigm, and in which the correct response rewarded 70% of the time in the first half of the task was these yellow bars, and then in the second half of the task, the correct response rewarded 70% of the time was the blue response. And subjects had to learn to press this, and then they had to learn that they had to stop pressing that and press this instead. And the subjects with this polymorphism, which results in a slightly higher level of dopamine at these D2 receptors in the striatum, just made more perseverative errors than these other subjects. So this is the exact same kind of effect, although the paradigm is slightly different. So maybe this D2 receptor hyperactivity is actually something that is causing delusions to be maintained rather than to arise in the first place. And maybe it has something to do with the precision of policies rather than of prediction errors. So lastly, doing for time. Okay, so I'll just quickly go through some models of negative symptoms. So trying to model negative symptoms basically comes down to this very, very, very simple question, which is why not act to get reward? And this sounds like the ideal question for anyone studying reinforcement learning. Unfortunately, there are many answers to this question. But we can review some potential ones. So for one explanation might be that you just don't value rewards. Maybe people with schizophrenia just don't enjoy things to the same extent that other people do. People thought this for a long time because they don't express the same enjoyment as other people do. There may be a problem of learning to associate certain stimuli with rewards. So if you can't associate rewards with certain stimuli, then when you see those stimuli, you won't act to get the reward. There may be more complex things going on. So you might not be able to learn the values of performing particular actions. Or you might not be able to compare the values of one stimulus versus the values of another stimulus and decide on which one is better. You may have problems doing cost-benefit analysis. So if the costs of doing anything always seem to outweigh the benefits of that action, then you might not act. And lastly, if you don't explore your environment, then you never find new stimulus-reward pairings, and you just remain stuck in the same series of habits without discovering new rewards. This is all taken from a paper by Strauss et al., which I recommend. It's all based on work done by him and Jim Gold's lab in Maryland and Baltimore. So to answer this first question, it seems that if you actually test subjective and neural hedonic responses in schizophrenia, that they seem normal. So people do seem to enjoy rewards the same amount as normal subjects, it's just they don't seem to act to go and get them. So this one perhaps can be struck off the list. So what about learning to associate stimuli with rewards? Right. So the interesting thing, as I was alluding to with in the study in Paul Fletcher a few slides ago, is that when in these conditioning paradigms where people have to associate stimuli which result in gain 80% of the time or loss 80% of the time or gain 90% of the time or loss 90% of the time, they perform pretty much the same as normal subjects. And only in this single condition in this study where the stimuli predicted response with 90% probability did they fall down. So they seem pretty good at learning stimuli response associations using these kind of striatal reinforcement learning paradigms, which is odd on the face of it if you think that most of the pathology is in the striatum. But there seems to be more evidence for these more complex functions centered in prefrontal cortex. So there is evidence, which I don't have time to go into now, that patients with high negative symptoms aren't able to represent specific values of actions, and that they're not able to compare the values of different states, so functions subserved by orbitofrontal, ventromedial, prefrontal cortex. Likewise, that they have difficulty comparing, weighing up costs and values of acting, and likewise that they seem to have problems initiating exploration, again, another prefrontal function. But one really nice study that's worth looking at that came out last year was a study by Michael Frank and Collins, published in the Journal of Neuroscience. And they looked at this apparent reinforcement learning, apparent but mild reinforcement learning deficit in schizophrenia. and asked, is it, could it actually be explained purely by cognitive problems? So even might even this effect not actually be anything to do with a reinforcement learning problem? And the way they assessed this was by getting people to learn simple stimuli response associations to a set number of stimuli. So in different blocks, they were shown one stimulus. They had to make a simple response. They had key one, two, or three, and they were told whether they were right or wrong. And in the different blocks, they had different numbers of stimuli response associations to learn. And you can see how they did on this graph. This is the number of trials it took them to get to a high standard. And you can see the schizophrenic patients are just slower than these healthy controls. And they don't reach quite the same standard. And the way they modeled this task, they modeled it using the standard reinforcement learning parameters. So they had the learning rate and the decay rate of the reinforcement learning. And they had a softmax temperature and this another noise parameter. But they also had a working memory capacity, which allowed patients, and allowed all subjects, to learn a stimulus response association with a learning rate of one, i.e. you see it once and then you know it, instead of making an incremental gain like in reinforcement learning. So this working memory capacity was limited, though. So you couldn't hold six stimulus response associations in your working memory. You could only hold a few. And so they had some working memory parameters like the capacity, the decay rate from working memory, and the trade-off between working memory and reinforcement learning. And when they looked at their data, they discovered that these reinforcement learning parameters actually showed no difference between the patients and the normal subjects. So the learning rate was the same. There was no difference in the softmax parameter either, which is quite striking. The only differences are these ones plotted in red, were working memory differences. So there's a loss of working memory capacity and a higher decay rate from working memory, and therefore greater reliance on reinforcement learning rather than working memory in the patients. So this is a really nice illustration of how a more sophisticated model can tease out these subtle differences. So just to summarise, that's everything I've said, and thank you very much. Any questions?